crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We're coming to you today, this Sunday, from Jerusalem, Israel. I believe it's April 22nd. Thank you very much for joining us. There are a couple of things that I want to get to on today's program. The second, if we have time, will be an article that appeared in Israel Hayom yesterday. It's entitled A Generation Reborn, and its quip reads this: after the almost miraculous victory, and I would say miraculous victory, of this 1967 Six-Day War, Israel was created anew. Israel Hayom writer Nadav Shragai interviews four of his personal heroes who reflect the deep divides in the Israeli identity in the 50 years since then. And one of those whom he picked is none other than Dr. Eilat Mazar. He goes through some of her history. He interviewed her for this piece and details some of her family history, what she's discovered. I think a lot of our listeners, a lot of you out there will enjoy reading this. So if I don't get to it, I'll definitely leave it as a link on the internet or the SoundCloud show notes so that you can get to it and read it yourself. But before I get to that, I'm going to have to cover this article that was written on April 18th, 2018, at least it was published on that date in Haaretz, a newspaper here in Israel. It looks like I've been out to get this newspaper and a couple of their writers for some of the things they're writing of late. And indeed, that is the case, just because I disagree vehemently with some of their conclusions. Nevertheless, they have been putting a lot more effort into writing these stories. I don't know why they're writing them at this point. Maybe it's because it gets a lot of clicks, because they do. A lot of people right now are interested in biblical archaeology. A lot of people around the world are interested in it. A lot of Israelis are interested in it as well. And so this latest one is quite stunning in the history that it goes through. And I would say it is 95 or even 99% amazing, awesome. I definitely think it would be good for you to read this. However, it is off in perhaps 1% of the facts. And in that, because that, they had the whole premise of this article is wrong. And its whole conclusion of it, I believe, is not the conclusion that you will get if you read it. You will get a different conclusion from this article. It's entitled, How Mice, that's right, the little creatures that crawl around, How Mice May Have Saved Jerusalem 2,700 Years Ago from the Terrifying Assyrians. So if you're up with your biblical history, 2,700 years ago, you know, is talking about, in the context of the Assyrians, and we're talking about Jerusalem, it must be in the context of King Hezekiah of Judah, one of the righteous kings of Judah who reigned for almost 30 years on the throne there, in Jerusalem, and who came up against the terrifying Assyrians and Sennacherib, who was the emperor of that kingdom. And I will just quote from the first couple of paragraphs here, because I think they introduce the subject quite well, and then we'll go from there. It says this. This, again, I think the author, Philippe Bostrom. It starts out this way. The failure of the Assyrian king Sennacherib to capture Jerusalem is one of the more baffling events recorded in the Bible. Maybe not. Maybe not one of the more baffling events. I could think of a lot more baffling events that are less straightforward than this description of what happened. It's amazing. It's written in three different books: Chronicles, Kings, Isaiah. They all go through this same history, give a slightly different version of it, or a more completing vision of it when you combine them all together. And so, I don't think it's too baffling. Nevertheless, that's how he starts, and it is an intriguing first sentence. Then he writes this: even the ancients couldn't explain why the Assyrians, who had rolled over the region and were known for their might and cruelty, did not crush the Judahite capital and kill its king Hezekiah. That is just a stunning sentence, though. Everyone studying this, even the ancient historians, they couldn't explain what happened here. And to this day, nobody can really explain what happened here in Jerusalem, other than what the Bible, if you don't believe what the Bible actually says happened, then you can't really explain. People are baffled by the events. What happened 2,700 years ago, he says. The only source of information on biblical times, the Bible aside, is Assyrian and Egyptian records. On the upside, the extra-biblical records were usually contemporary to the actual events. On the downside, they may have been as colored by propaganda as scripture is by religion. To elucidate what happened when the Assyrians besieged Jerusalem, it's worth cross-checking all of these sources. So at least he puts the Bible on the same level or similar level to the Assyrian-Egyptian records. A lot of others wouldn't even go that far. Next paragraph. All these sources agree that by the time Jerusalem and Hezekiah faced the Assyrian battalions in 701 BCE, the Assyrians already controlled much of the Near East. But after some of the local kings had ceased paying their annual tribute, King Sennacherib's forces swept westward to reassert control and bring them to heel. City after city along the Phoenician coast fell. Frightened kings hastened to submissively send tribute. Recalcitrant cities such as Ashkelon were taken by force. Then the Assyrians reached Jerusalem. The weird thing is that they accepted tribute, left, and let Hezekiah, no toady of Assyria, live. They let him live. Almost 3 millennia later, people are still arguing how that came to pass. And so this is a really good question. I think it's a pretty good introduction as well to this article here in Haaretz, because it sets this up and says, we can tell from history, we can tell from history books, historians that wrote at the time, even actual Assyrian documents from that period, contemporaneous, written by Sennacherib's scribes himself, we can tell that this happened, and written in the Bible itself, that we have the mighty Assyrian Empire rising in power, sweeping across westward, all the way down to towards Egypt, conquering people after people, city after city. Everyone that stood up to Sennacherib fell, except one man, and his little city, especially in terms of the huge other cities that were taken, Jerusalem. They weren't able to conquer Jerusalem, Sennacherib's forces. Why not? And as he says there, almost 3 millennia later, people are still arguing how that came to pass. Why did Sennacherib not take Jerusalem? Why did he not bring Hezekiah to heel for his rebellion? Again, you've got the mighty Assyrian Empire here. And little old Judah. What happened? He writes this, the Hebrew sources for what ensued, a 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, Micah, and Isaiah. We also have the annals of Sennacherib, reliefs found on the Assyrian city of Nineveh, and remains of a siege found in Lachish. Herodotus, the Greek historian, he writes about it, and 600 years later, the Jewish Roman historian Josephus. And so he goes through the different historians and their versions of events and just marks some of the differences between them. Not much is written differently between them. They all write that Sennacherib came down. This was his third campaign in 701 to secure Phoenicia, as I said, and also to secure some of these cities that had refused to pay tribute to him, Hezekiah being one of them. And so he was going to come down and bring them to heel. Make them obey. Cart them off into captivity if he had to, like the previous Assyrian rulers had to the northern tribes of Israel just 20 years earlier. And he started to do this. And then it writes this in the article. It talks about how there are some holes in the Assyrians' way that they described it. Of course, Sennacherib isn't going to talk about his defeat in Jerusalem or why he didn't take Jerusalem. He's going to be writing about how awesome he was elsewhere. That's why we likely have, if you've gone to the British Museum, the room full of some of the reliefs from the palace in Nineveh, Sennacherib's palace in Nineveh, modern Mosul, where Mosul is today in northern Iraq. You have walls and walls, just a massive room depicting this battle scene of Lachish, the second largest city in Israel, or in Judah, sorry, that was defeated just before his army marched on Jerusalem. And he's just writing about how amazing it was and how amazing he was, how he took, as it says here in the Assyrian records, 200,000 captives with him after this city, after taking this city. And that's what he's praising himself for. And yet he doesn't mention it much about Jerusalem at all. Maybe he was making up for something. Maybe he was trying to aggrandize his story to hide the failure. That big old Sennacherib, king of the world, as he called himself in his documents, was unable to conquer Jerusalem and its king, King Hezekiah. Now, there's a lot that's come up recently from King Hezekiah's time. I mentioned the seal of Isaiah the prophet, a seal of Isaiah the prophet found by Dr. Elot Mazar recently on the Ophel excavations. And then before that, in the same strata of soil, we had released back in 2015, the seal of none other than the king of Judah himself, belonging to Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah. That's what the seal says, found in the right strata. No one denies it, thinks it's a fraud unless you're some crazy wacko that has an agenda behind you. Most Israelis, believing in the Bible or not, as far as archaeology is concerned, in its history, believe this is real. This is real. This was the man. So Hezekiah, we've proven, existed. And yet, he, in the Assyrian records, doesn't get too much of a mention as far as what happened to him in Jerusalem. This is all that it says about Jerusalem and Hezekiah. This is in his annals, Sennacherib's annals, written on the Tale of Prism as well. That's in the British Museum also. It writes this: Hezekiah, I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, in his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. Like a bird in a cage. Little old Hezekiah was just caught like a bird in a cage. That's what I did to him. But there's no mention in the Assyrian documents of what happened to Hezekiah as far as the battle. This wasn't like Sennacherib to leave somebody alive like this, like a bird in the cage. Wouldn't you rather take the bird out of the cage and do what you normally do to everybody, every other leader that will not obey you? This is some parts of this article are pretty good in the history that they cover. This is what the Assyrians did. This is what the Assyrians did to people that rebelled. This is talking about Sennacherib, or I think it's Ashpenurple, another one of the Assyrian rulers from this period. This is one of their documents. Quote, I built a pillar over against his city gate. This is speaking of a different city. This is what happens when they lay siege to a city and are successful. The Assyrians, that is. I built a pillar over against his city gate, and I flayed all the chief men. Who flayed? Flayed, meaning taking their skins while they were still alive. I flayed all the chief men who had revolted, and I covered the pillar with their skins. Some I walled up within the pillar. Some I impaled upon the pillar on stakes. And I cut off the limbs of the officers, off the royal officers who had rebelled. And there's pictures of them doing this. Ancient carvings of them doing this. This is what they did. This is what they did to cities that rebelled and to rulers that rebelled. Take no prisoners if they are the leadership. They are going to make an example of them, that they shouldn't rebel against the mighty Assyrian Empire. This is what they're like. This is what should have happened to King Hezekiah, but it didn't. But it didn't, as you know. Another one of these Assyrian documents from the period says this: many captives from among them I burned with fire, and many I took as living captives. From some I cut off their hands and their fingers, and from others I cut off their noses, their ears. Of many I put out their eyes. I made one pillar of the living and another of heads, and I bound their heads to posts, that is tree trunks, round about the city. Their young men and maidens I burned with fire, 20 men I captured alive, and I immured them in the wall of his palace. The rest of them, their warriors, I consumed with thirst in the desert of the Euphrates. As he writes here, as the author writes of this article, as he quotes them, in Haaretz. He says, no wonder people were terrified of them when resistance would crumble. No wonder the Phoenician coastal cities surrendered without hesitation at the mere sight of the Assyrians. No wonder the Phoenician king fled overseas. No wonder even Hezekiah, he said, instantly paid heavy tribute after Lachish fell. Since Assyrians were not famed for having a live-and-let-go policy for their enemies, questions emerge about what on earth happened in the Judah campaign. Now, as a bit of history, I'm not going to go into that. We have an article on Watch Jerusalem written by Christopher Reams, area supervisor of the Ophel excavations, and he's written up about King Hezekiah and all the different biblically significant artifacts that have been discovered, really proving this story extremely true. I mean, I feel like there's no other biblical story or part of biblical history that has been confirmed more than the history surrounding King Hezekiah, just because the Assyrians were great writers. They loved to write about what they did or what they couldn't do in this case. And they memorialized it on their walls. And the Assyrians were the ones that were coming against the Judahites here, or the Jews, King Hezekiah. And so there's a lot written about it, confirming the history that happened. But I just want to read this one sentence here from this article. It says, since Assyrians were not famed for having the live-and-let-go policy for their enemies, questions emerge about what on earth happened in the Judah campaign. And you can read all about what exactly happened in that article about King Hezekiah. And again, I'll leave a link for you. It's called Hezekiah, A Story, A King, A Legacy. You can just go to the Watch Jerusalem website, watchjerusalem.co.il, and click on the archaeology tab, and it will be on the sidebar to your left if you want to read that article. So, what on earth happened? What on earth happened? Let's answer that question. There are a lot of theories out there about what on earth happened. And let's just read the theory that this man has here. And this, again, is the author of this article. This is under the heading Angel versus Bacteria. This is Philippe Bostrom. He writes this. The Bible also says that 185,000 Assyrian soldiers died in one night while besieging Jerusalem. It says that number might be a little bit off, maybe or not. And then it says that basically the death angel, it says, or an angel, came along and put them to death. That is what the Bible says about what happened to these soldiers as they besieged Jerusalem. And again, this is an incredible story because the Assyrians had wiped out everything in their path, including 46 cities of the Jews already. This was the last city remaining, the last city that was alive and had Jews in it that hadn't fallen to the Assyrians. That's why it's important. And then he writes this, by and large, the biblical and Assyrian accounts harmonize on many core events. Crucially, both accounts agree that Sennacherib did conquer Lachish and overran almost all of Judah, but not Jerusalem. Then he says, leaving gods out of it. There could be other explanations for Jerusalem and Hezekiah's survival, such as mice. You heard me right, mice. Let's just put God out of the picture right now, because that's obviously not true. That can't be the case, that God intervened, that this being called God is alive, and that he delivered King Hezekiah, with the help, of course, and the guidance of the prophet Isaiah. That can't be the case. Let's investigate all the other possibilities, one of them being mice. That mice saved Jerusalem. Jewish historian Josephus, writing in the first century CE, he connects the dots for us, apparently. When Sennacherib returned to Jerusalem, he's quoting Josephus now, from his war with Egypt, he found the forces under Rabshakeh in danger or from the plague. So he's talking about there was this force that belonged to the Sennacherib, but he wasn't in charge of it, which is true at this point when they came to Jerusalem. Another man was in charge of it. Then he says, from a plague, for God had visited pestilential sickness upon his army, and on the first night of the siege, 185,000 men perished with their commanders and officers. So, he's saying, because of Josephus says that there was some type of pestilence that ended up putting to death 185,000 people, maybe that was mice, and he bases that on what something that happens to Assyrians written in Egypt written by the historian Herodotus, a 5th century historian. So he's putting them together, and he says, well, maybe Herodotus had a kind of a different story, and Josephus is kind of borrowing from that a little bit, and maybe there was a pestilence that was on the mice, and then the mice bit all the soldiers, and they all died in one night. Now, notice Josephus there, though, in that quote, he at least says that this plague had come from God, this pestilence had come from God, and yet this man that's writing, he's going to take God out of the picture and just say that it was a pestilence on mice, probably. Some type of plague went through there, just happened to happen, and now we have 185,000 people dead in one night. The whole Assyrian army is wiped out, Sennacherib's men are gone, and it was all because of mice. Just happened to be there at the time attacking their army as it lay wait to destroy Jerusalem on day one of their siege. Now, this author isn't saying for sure that this is the way that it happened, but he's giving it enough thought and enough time to say that maybe it happened this way, because he can see that Sennacherib had a policy of doing a certain thing, taking over these places, killing most people that he found, especially the leadership, to bring them to heel, and it didn't happen here. It didn't happen here. All the sources agree that it didn't happen for Jerusalem. So what changed? He writes this. Why did Sennacherib change policy? Why didn't he dethrone the rebellious King Hezekiah and replace him with a loyal subject? Why wasn't Jerusalem captured like the other capital cities? At the end of the day, it had to be that disease or another calamity that struck the Assyrian camp, and the Assyrians had to break off the campaign. That is the only feasible explanation why the Assyrians didn't conquer Jerusalem. They were simply incapable. Now, credit to him for saying that. They broke it off for some reason. They were unable to conquer Jerusalem for some reason. What could it be? I don't know what it is. It could be mice, he says. That's what it could have been. But at least he's willing to admit that something out of the ordinary happened here. This wasn't Assyrian policy. Assyrian policy is to lay siege to a city until it's destroyed, and to do those horrible things to the people that live there, especially the ruler. That's what would have happened to Jerusalem, unless something dramatic forced King Sennacherib to change course. Now, what does the Bible actually say? I'm going to read from 2 Kings chapter 19 for the first few verses, then drop down towards the end. It says this, "And it came to pass, when King Hezekiah heard it, and rent his clothes, and covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of the Eternal, and he sent Eliakim, which was over the house, and Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos." This is what he did when he knew that he was in trouble, that he knew that he couldn't do anything. He tried to pay him off. He tried to pay, Sennacherib, I'll pay you some tribute. He even raided the temple to do so, stripped some of the temple's wealth, Hezekiah did, to do so. Even gave some of his famous singers up to Sennacherib. But that didn't hold Sennacherib back. He wanted Hezekiah, he wanted Jerusalem, and now he's worried, and so he's going to Isaiah, and he's dressing in sackcloth, he's humbling himself, going to God's prophet, who, by the way, in the past month and a half, or February 22nd, the seal impression of whom was discovered, of Isaiah the prophet. He went to Isaiah the prophet and says, "What should I do? What should I do?" And Isaiah answered him, answered these messages and said in verse 6, "Go back to him and say to your master," that is King Hezekiah, "Thus says the Eternal, be not afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me." God knew where this was, who the Assyrian king was blaspheming. He understood that it was towards him, his power, because Sennacherib, of course, he was talking about the fact that, why are you trusting in your God, people? Come on. I've been here before, in the sense that all these other cities that said that their God was going to protect him or protect them, my God was stronger than their God. I defied them. As it says here in verse 11, this is what Sennacherib said back to them, "Behold, you have heard of what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands by destroying them utterly." By destroying them utterly, that's what they did. "And shall you be delivered?" Verse 12, have the gods of the nations delivered them, which my fathers have destroyed, as Gozan, Haran, Refseph, children of Eden, which were in Telzar? Where is the king of Hamath? And you go to Hamath, they've dug that, and that destruction has been found of the Assyrians at this time. Where is he? Where's the king of Arphad? Where's the king of the city of Seraphim, or Hena, or Iva? You think your god's going to protect you? Think about all these other gods, or the cities, and their gods that fell to me. And so Hezekiah then takes this letter that he received back. He goes to the temple, outstretches this letter right before God and prays to God, reads some of the letter and says, God, will you please deal with this? This is your fight. This is your fight. And so God responds in this way through Isaiah the prophet to Hezekiah. This is verse 32 of the same chapter. Therefore, thus says the Eternal concerning this king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with a shield, nor cast a bank upon it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, says the Eternal. For I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. God says, you've responded finally here, Hezekiah, correctly, and I'm going to protect this city. What unusual circumstance led to Sennacherib's men withdrawing? This man that writes for Haaretz can read this article, and he says, looking at all the history here, looking at the Assyrian documents, the Egyptian documents, Herodotus, Josephus, the Bible, something against his normal policy happened. What could it be? Is it a plague on some mice, or is it this? That God said, I will defend my city for my servant's sake and for David and my own sake. Verse 35, and it came to pass that night, day one of the siege, that night, that the angel of the Eternal went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000, and when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. Every single one, they're all dead corpses. 185,000 men gone in one night before they had the chance to shoot an arrow at the city, before they could come against it with a shield, before they could cast a bank against it. I would say this type of action probably would make Sennacherib change his policy. I would say this type of action was the reason why that he couldn't do to King Hezekiah as he had done to all the rebellious kings before him. I would say this was the reason why Jerusalem wasn't captured like the other cities before it had been. That's what I would say happened. If you don't believe that that's the way that happened, then you're going to have to come up with another good excuse for it or another reason. And you might be clutching at straws to the point that you believe that mice actually did it. Now, I'm just going to go to the very conclusion of this article here now. At the end of the day, all accounts, the Assyrians, the Bibles, and Herodotus interpret events. They didn't invent them. Something unexpected happened to the Assyrian army, which the people of the ancient Near East attributed to divine meddling. That's what they did. They believed it was divine, that something happened here from God. That's what the writers believed happened. The ancient kings had to keep their subjects and gods happy, and propaganda was the most effective way to distort history and cover up failure. Sennacherib's failure to conquer Jerusalem was embarrassing and was overcompensated by grand reliefs on palace walls and extravagant claims of plunder. The fact that one of the main instigators of the Assyrian rebellion, Hezekiah, remained on the throne, albeit denuded of his wealth and women, may say it all. That's all we can take away from this, that something inexplicable happened here, and that Hezekiah got to stay on the throne. Now, this is unfortunate, I believe, this type of conclusion, because even as he paints in his article, and even as we have in our article, on Hezekiah and this, the relationship here with the Assyrians, more than any other biblical story, this history of Sennacherib's failed campaign to Jerusalem is probably the most that's been backed up by secular sources and by archaeology. The wealth of physical evidence is there for everybody to see, including this author, and he writes it up very well. And the narrative, as he even says, fits out with the Bible perfectly. And even as this article brings out, a thinking person has to accept that the story in the Bible here is actually correct. Is correct. Well, almost correct. At least to the point of attributing the death of the Assyrian army to God. That couldn't have happened. It couldn't have been God that did that. The rest of the story, as the Bible says, that's correct, but just not that. Okay, so what was it then? Was it mice? Mice, really? Are we really willing to be more accepting that the crazy idea that mice mysteriously bit every single one of those 185,000 troops, killing them all so fast overnight before any of them could wake up, stamp on that little mouse to death to stop it happening? You wouldn't hear a commotion of people being nibbled on by mice in one night. What lengths the human mind will go to not accept the existence of God and the fact that he does intervene in the affairs of men. Now, what does God think looking at an article like this? It lays out all the proof, all the archaeological evidence, stacks it up against the Bible, and it surmises, well, it really does check out, everybody. And then its conclusion is, well, we just don't really know. We can't be sure what happened. Surely we are, mankind is, a little more hard-headed than we like to think. We glorify science, but when science and archaeology point to the supernatural or something extremely out of the ordinary happening, we just deny it. We deny what's most logical. We pick mice instead of God. Now, studying the example of Hezekiah's life here as recorded in the Bible and then doing a study of what the Assyrian documents say should cause a thinking person to stop and analyze whether God is real. Now, mankind largely already made up their mind, individual's mind on that question. And so going through an article like this, you'd have to come up with other solutions, like mice. Now, as I said earlier, this story, this history of Hezekiah and Sennacherib is amazingly documented both in the Bible. God's made sure that it was written in 3 or 4 different books. And then you have all these archaeological discoveries that have come to the surface in the past 100 years to present a history and a story that matches identically with the Bible. It's like God is just putting this evidence out there and saying, what do you think? What do you think happened here? Was it me that protected them? Well, am I real? Look into this history. What do you think? What do you think yourself? Or was it mice? Was it something else that delivered the Jews here? Why can't this author and anyone else studying this just give credit to God? Why choose mice? Well, really, isn't that what we've been doing, mankind's been doing for 6,000 years? Burying our head in the sand, choosing mice, choosing gods of our own devising, choosing creations of our own hands to worship, or now it seems choosing the greatness of our own intellect, choosing to believe anything rather than God. Well, that doesn't have to be you, and I challenge you to study through the example of Hezekiah in the book of Chronicles, Kings, and Isaiah, and then study what's been discovered archaeologically, dug up by people, a lot of them that don't even believe in the Bible. And you see for yourself how it checks out. Again, we have an article that can help you in this. I mean, it's all factual. You can read through it and see that yourself. This article, I'll leave a link for it. It's on King Hezekiah on our website, watchjerusalem.co.il. And you go through that, put your prejudice aside, let the facts speak to you and ask yourself, if the Bible has 99% of this history correct, why not 100%? Was it God that turned around the Assyrian army, or was it mice? That's all we have time for on today's program. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen to us. If you would like to send some feedback, you can do that by sending your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.